pond was a side trail, the Garvey Springs Trail, which descended very steeply to an old paved road along the river, just below a spot called Tox Island, and which would take me in a lazy loop back towards the visitor center where I had left the car. It was 4 miles, and the day was growing warm, but the road was shaded and quiet. I saw only 3 cars in an hour or so. So it was a pleasant stroll, with restful views of the river across overgrown meadows. By American standards, the Delaware is not a particularly imposing waterway, but it has one almost unique characteristic. It is nearly the last significant undammed river in the United States. Now, this might seem an inestimable virtue, a river that runs as nature planned it. However, one consequence of its unregulated nature is that the Delaware regularly floods. In 1955, as Frank Dale notes in his excellent book, Delaware Diary, there was a flood that even now is remembered as the big one. In August of that year, ironically at the height of one of the most severe droughts in decades, 2 hurricanes hit North Carolina one after the other, disrupting and enlivening weather all up and down the East Coast. The first dumped 10 inches of rain in 2 days on the Delaware River Valley. 6 days later, the valley received 10 inches in less than 24 hours. At a place called Camp Davis, a holiday complex, 46 people, mostly women and children, took refuge from the rising floodwaters in the camp's main building. As the waters rose, they fled first upstairs and then into the attic, but to no avail. Sometime in the night, a 30-foot wall of water came roaring through the valley and swept the house away. Amazingly, 9 people survived. Elsewhere, bridges were being brushed aside and riverside towns inundated. Before the day was out, the Delaware River would rise 43 feet. By the time the waters finally receded, 400 people were dead, and the whole of the Delaware Valley was devastated. Into this gooey mess stepped the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, with a plan to build a dam at Tox Island, very near where I was walking now. The dam, according to the Corps' plan, would not only tame the river but allow the creation of a new national park, at the heart of which would be a recreational lake almost 40 miles long. 8,000 residents were moved out. It was all done very clumsily. One of the people evicted was blind. Several farmers had only parts of their land bought, so that they ended up with farmland but no house, or a farmhouse but no land. A woman whose family had farmed the same land since the 18th century was carried from her house kicking and bellowing, to the delight of newspaper photographers and film crews. The thing about the Army Corps of Engineers is that they don't build things very well. A dam across the Missouri River in Nebraska silted up so disastrously that a noisome ooze began to pour into the town of Niobrara, eventually forcing its permanent abandonment. Then, a Corps dam in Idaho failed. Fortunately, it was in a thinly populated area, and there was some warning. Even so, several small towns were washed away, and 11 people lost their lives. But these were relatively small dams. Tox Dam would have held one of the largest artificial reservoirs in the world, with 40 miles of water behind it. 4 substantial cities, Trenton, Camden, Wilmington, and Philadelphia, and scores of smaller communities stood downstream. A disaster on the Delaware would truly be a disaster. And here was the nimble Army Corps of Engineers planning to hold back 250 billion gallons of water with notoriously unstable glacial till. Besides that, there were all kinds of environmental worries. That salinity levels below the dam would rise catastrophically, for example, devastating the ecology lower down, not least the valuable oyster beds of Delaware Bay. In 1992, after years of growing protests that spread far beyond the Delaware Valley, the dam plan was finally put on hold. But by this time, whole villages and farms had been bulldozed. A quiet, remote, very beautiful farming valley that had not changed a great deal in 200 years was lost forever. One beneficial result of the canceled project, notes the Appalachian Trail Guide to New York and New Jersey, was that the land acquired by the federal government for the National Recreation Area has provided the trail with a protected corridor. To tell you the truth, I was getting a little wearied of this. I know the Appalachian Trail is supposed to be a wilderness experience, and I accept that there are countless places where it would be a tragedy for it to be otherwise, But sometimes, as here, the ATC seems to be positively phobic about human contact. Personally, I would have been pleased to be walking now through hamlets and past farms rather than through some silent protected corridor. Doubtless, it is all to do with our historic impulse to tame and exploit the wilderness, but America's attitude to nature is, from all sides, very strange, if you ask me. I couldn't help comparing my experience now with an experience I'd had 3 or 4 years earlier in Luxembourg when I went hiking with my son for a magazine assignment. Luxembourg is a much more delightful place to hike than you might think. It has lots of woods, but also castles and farms and steepled villages and winding river valleys. The whole, as it were, European package. The footpaths we followed spent a lot of time in the woods, but also emerged at obliging intervals to take us along sunny back roads and over stiles and through farm fields and hamlets. We were always able at some point each day to call in at a bakery or post office, to hear the tinkle of shop bells and eavesdrop on conversations we couldn't understand. Each night we slept in an inn and ate in a restaurant with other people. We experienced the whole of Luxembourg, not just its trees. It was wonderful. And it was wonderful because the whole charmingly diminutive package was seamlessly and effortlessly integrated. In America, alas, beauty has become something you drive to, and nature an either-or proposition. Either you ruthlessly subjugate it, as at Tox Dam and a million other places, or you deify it, treat it as something holy and remote, a thing apart, as along the Appalachian Trail. Seldom would it occur to anyone on either side that people and nature could coexist to their mutual benefit, that, say, a more graceful bridge across the Delaware River might actually set off the grandeur around it, or that the AT might be more interesting and rewarding if it wasn't all wilderness, if from time to time it purposely took you past grazing cows and tilled fields. I would much have preferred it if the AT guidebook had said, "Thanks to the conference's efforts, farming has been restored to the Delaware River Valley, and the footpath rerouted to incorporate 16 miles of riverside walking, because, let's face it, you can get too much of trees sometimes." Still, we must look on the bright side. If the Army Corps of Engineers had had its foolish way, I'd have been swimming back to my car now, and I was grateful at least to be spared that. Anyway, it was time to do some real hiking again. Chapter 16. In 1983, a man walking in the Berkshire Hills of Massachusetts, just off the Appalachian Trail, saw, or at least swears he saw, a mountain lion cross his path, which was a little unsettling and even more unexpected, since mountain lions hadn't been seen in the northeastern United States since 1903, when the last one was shot in New York State. Soon, however, sightings were being reported all over New England. A man driving a back road of Vermont saw two cubs playing at the roadside. A pair of hikers saw a mother and two cubs cross a meadow in New Hampshire. Every year there were half a dozen or more reports in similar vein, all by credible witnesses. In the late winter of 1994, a farmer in Vermont was walking across his property, taking some seed to a bird feeder, when he saw what appeared to be three mountain lions about 70 feet away. He stared dumbstruck for a minute or two, for mountain lions are swift, fierce creatures, and here were three of them looking at him with calm regard. Then hightailed it to a phone and called a state wildlife biologist. The animals were gone by the time the biologist arrived, but he found some fresh scat, which he dutifully bagged up and dispatched to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Laboratory. The lab report came back that it was indeed the scat of Felis concolor, the eastern mountain lion, also variously and respectfully known as the panther, cougar, puma, and especially in New England, catamount. All of this was of some interest to me, for I was hiking in about the same spot as that initial mountain lion sighting. I was back on the trail with a new keenness and determination, and a new plan. I was going to hike New England, or at least as much of it as I could knock off, until Katz returned in 7 weeks to walk with me through Maine's 100-mile wilderness. There are almost 700 miles of gorgeously mountainous Appalachian Trail in New England, about a third of the AT's total trail length, enough to keep me occupied till August. To that end, I had my obliging wife drive me to southwestern Massachusetts and drop me on the trail near Stockbridge for a 3-day amble through the Berkshires. Thus it was that I was to be found, on a hot morning in mid-June, laboring sweatily up a steep but modest eminence called Beckett Mountain, in a haze of repellent-resistant black flies, and patting my pocket from time to time to check that my knife was still there. I didn't really expect to encounter a mountain lion, but only the day before I had read an article in the Boston Globe about how western mountain lions, which indubitably are not extinct, had recently taken to stalking and killing hikers and joggers in the California woods, and even the odd poor soul standing at a backyard barbecue in an apron and funny hat. It seemed a kind of omen. It's not entirely beyond the realm of possibility that mountain lions could have survived undetected in New England. Bobcats, admittedly much smaller creatures than mountain lions, are known to exist in considerable numbers, and yet are so shy and furtive that you would never guess their existence. Many forest rangers go whole careers without seeing one, and there is certainly ample room in the eastern woods for large cats to roam undisturbed. Massachusetts alone has 250,000 acres of woodland, 100,000 of it in the comely Berkshires. From where I was now, I could, given the will, and a more or less infinite supply of noodles, walk all the way to Cape Chidley in northern Quebec, 1,800 miles away, on the icy Labrador Sea, and scarcely ever have to leave the cover of trees. Even so, it is unlikely that a large cat could survive in sufficient numbers to breed not just in one area, but evidently all over New England, and escape notice for 9 decades. Still, there was the scat. Whatever it was, it excreted like a mountain lion. The most plausible explanation was that any lions out there, if lions they were released pets, bought in haste and later regretted. It would be just my luck, of course, to be savaged by an animal with a flea collar and a medical history. I imagined lying on my back, being extravagantly ravaged, inclining my head slightly to read a dangling silver tag that said, "My name is Mr. Bojangles. If found, please call Tanya and Vinny at 924-4667. Like most large animals, and a good many small ones, the eastern mountain lion was wiped out because it was deemed to be a nuisance. Until the 1940s, many eastern states had well-publicized varmint campaigns, often run by state conservation departments, that awarded points to hunters for every predatory creature they killed, which was just about every creature there was: hawks, owls, kingfishers, eagles, and virtually any type of large mammal. West Virginia gave an annual college scholarship to the student who killed the most animals. Other states freely distributed bounties and other cash rewards. Rationality didn't often come into it. Pennsylvania one year paid out $90,000 in bounties for the killing of 130,000 owls and hawks to save the state's farmers a slightly less than whopping $1,875 in estimated livestock losses. It is not very often, after all, that an owl carries off a cow. As late as 1890, New York State paid bounties on 107 mountain lions, but within a decade they were virtually all gone. The very last wild eastern mountain lion was killed in the Smokies in the 1920s. The timber wolf and woodland caribou also disappeared from their last Appalachian fastnesses in the first years of this century, and the black bear very nearly followed them. In 1900, the bear population of New Hampshire, now over 3,000, had fallen to just 50. There is still quite a lot of life out there, but it is mostly very small. According to a wildlife census by an ecologist at the University of Illinois named V.E. Shelford, a typical 10-square-mile block of eastern American forest holds almost 300,000 mammals, 220,000 mice and other small rodents, 63,500 squirrels and chipmunks, 470 deer, 30 foxes, and 5 black bears. The real loser in the eastern forests has been the songbird. One of the most striking losses was the Carolina parakeet, a lovely, innocuous bird, whose numbers in the wild were possibly exceeded only by the unbelievably numerous passenger pigeon. When the first pilgrims came to America, there were an estimated 9 billion passenger pigeons, more than twice the number of all birds found in America today. Both were hunted out of existence, the passenger pigeon for pig feed, and the simple joy of blasting volumes of birds from the sky with blind ease, the Carolina parakeet because it ate farmers' fruit and had a striking plumage that made a lovely lady's hat. In 1914, the last surviving members of each species died within weeks of each other in captivity. A similar unhappy fate awaited the delightful Bachman's warbler. Always rare, it was said to have one of the loveliest songs of all birds. For years it escaped detection, but in 1939, two birders, operating independently in different places, coincidentally saw a Bachman's warbler within 2 days of each other. Both shot the birds. Nice work, boys. And that, it appears, was that for the Bachman's warbler. But there are almost certainly others that disappeared before anyone much noticed. John James Audubon painted three species of bird, the small-headed flycatcher, the carbonated warbler, and the blue mountain warbler, that have not been seen by anyone since. The same is true of Townsend's bunting, of which there is one stuffed specimen in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. Between the 1940s and 1980s, the populations of migratory songbirds fell by 50% in the eastern United States, in large part because of loss of breeding sites and other vital wintering habitats in Latin America, and by some estimates are continuing to fall by 3% or so a year. 70% of all eastern bird species have seen population declines since the 1960s. These days, the woods are a pretty quiet place. Late in the afternoon, I stepped from the trees onto what appeared to be a disused logging road. In the center of the road stood an older guy with a pack and a curiously bewildered look, as if he had just woken from a trance and found himself unaccountably in this place. He had, I noticed, a haze of black flies of his own.
"Which way's the trail go, do you suppose?"
he asked me. It was an odd question, because the trail clearly and obviously continued on the other side. There was a 3-foot gap in the trees directly opposite, and, in case there was any possible doubt, a white blaze painted on a stout oak. I swatted the air before my face for the 12,000th time that day, and nodded at the opening. "Just there, I'd say."
"Oh, yes," he answered. "Of course."
We set off into the woods together, and chatted a little about where we had come from that day, where we were headed, and so on. He was a thru-hiker, the first I had seen this far north, and like me, he was making for Dalton. He had an odd, puzzled look all the time, and regarded the trees in a peculiar way, running his gaze slowly up and down their lengths over and over again, as if he had never seen anything like them before. "So what's your name?" I asked him.
"Well, they call me Chicken John."
"Chicken John?" Chicken John was famous. I was quite excited. Some people on the trail take on an almost mythic status because of their idiosyncrasies. Early in the trip, Katz and I kept hearing about a kid who had equipment so high-tech that no one had ever seen anything like it. One of his possessions was a self-erecting tent. Apparently, he would carefully open a stuff sack, and it would fly out, like joke snakes from a can. He also had a satellite navigation system, and goodness knows what else. The trouble was that his pack weighed about 95 pounds. He dropped out before he got to Virginia, so we never did see him. Woodrow Murphy, the walking fat man, had achieved this sort of fame the year before. Mary Ellen would doubtless have attracted a measure of it if she had not dropped out. Chicken John had it now, though I couldn't for the life of me recall why. It had been months before, way back in Georgia, that I had first heard of him. "So why do they call you Chicken John?" I asked.
"You know, I don't honestly know,"
he said, as if he had been wondering that himself for some time. "When did you start your hike?"
"January 27th.
"January 27th?" I said in small astonishment, and did a quick private calculation on my fingers. "That's almost 5 months."
"Don't I know it?"
he said with a kind of happy ruefulness. He had been walking for the better part of half a year, and he was still only 3/4 of the way to Katahdin. "What kind of..."
I didn't know quite how to put this. "What kind of miles are you doing, John?"
"Oh, about 14 or 15, if all goes well. Trouble is," he slid me a sheepish look, "I get lost a lot."
That was it. Chicken John was forever losing the trail and ending up in the most improbable places. Goodness knows how anyone could manage to lose the Appalachian Trail. It is the most clearly defined, well-blazed footpath imaginable. Usually it is the only thing in the woods that isn't woods. If you can distinguish between trees and a long open corridor through the trees, you will have no trouble finding your way along the AT. Where there might be any doubt at all, where a side trail enters or where the AT crosses a road, there are always blazes. Yet people do get lost. The famous Grandma Gatewood, for instance, was forever knocking on doors and asking where the heck she was. I asked him what was the most lost he had ever been.
37 miles, he said almost proudly.
I got off the trail on Blood Mountain in Georgia. Still don't know how exactly, and spent 3 days in the woods before I came to a highway. I thought I was a goner that time. I ended up in Tallulah Falls, even got my picture in the paper. The police gave me a ride back to the trail the next day and pointed me the right way. They were real nice.
Is it true you once walked 3 days in the wrong direction? He nodded happily.
2.5 days, to be precise. Luckily, I came to a town on the 3rd day, and I said to a feller, "Excuse me, young feller, where is this?" And he said, "Why, it's Damascus, Virginia, sir." And I thought, well, that's mighty strange, because I was in a place with the very same name just 3 days ago. And then I recognized the fire station.
How on earth do you... I decided to rephrase the question. How does it happen, John, exactly?
Well, if I knew that, I wouldn't do it, I suppose, he said with a kind of chuckle. All I know is that from time to time I end up a long way from where I want to be. But it makes life interesting, you know. I've met a lot of nice people, and a lot of free meals. Excuse me, he said abruptly. You sure we're going the right way?
Positive, he nodded.
I'd hate to get lost today. There's a restaurant in Dalton.
I understood this perfectly. If you're going to get lost, you don't want to do it on a restaurant day. We walked the last 6 miles together, but we didn't talk much after that. I was doing a 19-mile day, the longest I would do anywhere on the trail, and even though the grade was generally easy and I was carrying a light pack, I was real tired by late afternoon. John seemed content to have someone to follow, and in any case he had his hands full scrutinizing the trees. It was after 6 when we reached Dalton. John had the name of a man on Depot Street who let hikers camp in his backyard and use his shower, so I went with him to a gas station while we asked directions. When we emerged, he started off in precisely the wrong direction. "It's that way, John," I said.
"Of course it is," he agreed. "And the name's Bernard, by the way. I don't know where they got that Chicken John from."
I nodded and told him I would look for him the next day, but I never did see him again. I spent the night in a motel, and the next day hiked on to Cheshire. It was only 9 miles over easy terrain, but the blackfly made it a torment. I have never seen a scientific name for these tiny, vile, winged specks, so I don't know what they are other than a hovering mass that goes with you wherever you go and are forever in your ears and mouth and nostrils. Human sweat transports them to a realm of orgasmic ecstasy, and insect repellent only seems to excite them further. They are particularly relentless when you stop to rest or take a drink. So relentless that eventually you don't stop to rest and you drink while moving, and then spit out a tongueful of them. It's a kind of living hell. So it was with some relief that I stepped from their woodland realm in early afternoon and strolled into the sunny, dozing straggle that was the little community of Cheshire. Cheshire had a free hostel for hikers and a church on the main street. Massachusetts people do a lot for hikers, it seems. Elsewhere I had seen houses with signs inviting people to help themselves to water or pick apples from trees. But I didn't feel like a night in a bunkhouse. Still less a long afternoon sitting around with nothing to do, so I pushed on to Adams, 4 miles away up a baking highway, but with at least the prospect of a night in a motel and a choice of restaurants. Adams had just one motel, a dumpy place on the edge of town. I took a room and passed the rest of the afternoon strolling around,
idly looking in store windows and browsing through boxes of books in a thrift shop. Though, of course, there was nothing but Reader's Digest volumes and those strange books you see only in thrift shops, with titles like Home Drainage Encyclopedia, Volume 1, and Nod If You Can Hear Me, Living with a Human Vegetable. And afterwards wandered out into the country to look at Mount Greylock, my destination for the next day. Greylock is the highest eminence in Massachusetts, and the first hill over 3,000 feet since Virginia for northbound hikers. It's just 3,491 feet to the top, but, surrounded as it is by much smaller hills, it looks considerably bigger. It has, in any case, a certain imposing majesty that beckons. I was looking forward to it. And so, early the next morning, before the day's heat had a chance to get properly underway, a scorcher was forecast, I stopped in town for a can of pop and a sandwich for my lunch, and then set off on a wandering dirt road towards the Gould Trail, a side trail leading steeply up to the AT, and on to Greylock. Greylock is certainly the most literary of Appalachian mountains. Herman Melville, living on a farm called Arrowhead on its western side, stared at it from his study window while he wrote Moby Dick. And, according to Maggie Steer and Ron McAdow, in their excellent Into the Mountains, A History of New England's Peaks, claimed that its profile reminded him of a whale. When the book was finished, he and a group of friends hiked to the top and partied there till dawn. Nathaniel Hawthorne and Edith Wharton also lived nearby and set works there. And there was scarcely a literary figure associated with New England from the 1850s to the 1920s who didn't at some time hike or ride up to admire the view. Ironically, at the height of its fame, Greylock lacked much of the green-cloaked majesty it enjoys today. Its sides were mangy with the scars of logging, and the lower slopes were pitted with slate and marble quarries. Big ramshackle sheds and sawhouses poked into every view. All that healed and grew over, but then in the 1960s, with the enthusiastic support of state officials in Boston, plans were drawn up to turn Greylock into a ski resort, with an aerial tram, a network of chairlifts, and a summit complex consisting of a hotel, shops, and restaurants, all in soaring 1960s Jetson-style architecture. But luckily, nothing ever came of it. Today, Greylock sits on 11,600 acres of preserved land. It's a beauty. The hike to the top was steep, hot, and seemingly endless, but worth the effort. The open, sunny, fresh-aired summit of Greylock is crowned with a large, handsome stone building called Bascom Lodge, built in the 1930s by the tireless cadres of the Civilian Conservation Corps. It now offers a restaurant and overnight accommodation to hikers. Also on the summit is a wonderful, wildly incongruous lighthouse. Greylock is 140 miles from the sea, which serves as the Massachusetts memorial for soldiers killed in the First World War. It was originally planned to stand in Boston Harbor, but for some reason ended up here. I ate my lunch, treated myself to a pee and a wash in the lodge, and then hurried on, for I still had 8 miles to go and had a rendezvous arranged with my wife at 4 in Williamstown. For the next 3 miles, the walk was mostly along a lofty ridgeline connecting Greylock to Mount Williams. The views were sensational, across lazy hills to the Adirondacks, half a dozen miles to the west, but it was really hot. Even up here the air was heavy and listless. And then it was a very steep descent, 3,000 feet in 3 miles, through dense, cool green woods to a back road that led through exquisitely pretty open countryside. Out of the woods it was sweltering. It was 2 miles along a road totally without shade and so hot I could feel the heat through the soles of my boots. When at last I reached Williamstown, a sign on a bank announced a temperature of 97. No wonder I was hot. I crossed the street and stepped into a Burger King, a rendezvous point. If there is a greater reason for being grateful to live in the 20th century than the joy of stepping from the dog's breath air of a really hot summer's day into the crisp, clean, surgical chill of an air-conditioned establishment, then I really cannot think of it. I bought a bucket-sized Coke and sat in a booth by the window, feeling very pleased. I had done 17 miles over a reasonably challenging mountain in hot weather. I was grubby, sweat-streaked, comprehensively bushed, and rank enough to turn heads. I was a walker again. In 1850, New England was 70% open farmland and 30% woods. Today, the proportions are exactly reversed. Probably no area in the developed world has undergone a more profound change in just a century or so, at least not in a contrary direction to the normal course of progress. If you were going to be a farmer, you could hardly choose a worse place than New England. Well, the middle of Lake Erie, maybe, but you know what I mean. The soil is rocky, the terrain steep, and the weather so bad that people take actual pride in it. A year in Vermont, according to an old saw, is 9 months of winter followed by 3 months of very poor sledding. But until the middle of the 19th century, farmers survived in New England because they had proximity to the coastal cities like Boston and Portland, and because, I suppose, they didn't know any better. Then two things happened. The invention of the McCormick Reaper, which was ideally suited to the big rolling farms of the Midwest, but no good at all for the cramped, stony fields of New England, and the development of the railroads, which allowed the Midwestern farmers to get their produce to the East in a timely fashion. The New England farmers couldn't compete, and so they became Midwestern farmers, too. By 1860, nearly half of Vermont-born people, 200,000 out of 450,000, were living elsewhere. In 1840, during the presidential election campaign, Daniel Webster gave an address to 20,000 people on Stratton Mountain in Vermont. Had he tried the same thing 20 years later, which admittedly would have been a good trick, as he had died in the meantime, he would have been lucky to get an audience of 50. Today, Stratton Mountain is pretty much all forest, though if you look carefully, you can still see old cellar holes and the straggly remnants of apple orchards clinging glumly to life in the shady understory beneath younger, more assertive birches, maples, and hickories. Everywhere throughout New England you find old, tumble-down field walls, often in the middle of the deepest, most settled-looking woods, a reminder of just how swiftly nature reclaims the land in America. And so I walked up Stratton Mountain on an overcast, mercifully cool June day. It was 4 steep miles to the summit at just under 4,000 feet. For a little over 100 miles through Vermont, the AT coexists with the Long Trail, which threads its way up and over the biggest and most famous peak of the Green Mountains all the way to Canada. The Long Trail is actually older than the AT. It was opened in 1921, the year the AT was proposed, and I'm told that there are Long Trail devotees even yet who look down on the AT, as a rather vulgar and overambitious upstart. In any case, Stratton Mountain is usually cited as the spiritual birthplace of both trails, for it was here that James P. Taylor and Benton McKay claimed to have received the inspiration that led to the creation of their wilderness ways, Taylor in 1909, McKay sometime afterwards. Stratton was a perfectly fine mountain, with good views across to several other well-known peaks, Equinox, Escutney, Snow, and Monadnock. But I couldn't say that it was a summit that would have inspired me to grab a hatchet and start clearing a route to Georgia or Quebec. Perhaps it was just the dull, heavy skies and bleak light which gave everything a flat, washed-out feel. 8 or 9 of the people were scattered around the summit, including one youngish, rather pudgy man on his own, in a very new and expensive-looking wind cheater. He had some kind of handheld electronic device with which he was taking mysterious readings of the sky or landscape. He noticed me watching and said, in a tone that suggested he was hoping someone would take an interest, "It's an enviro-monitor." "Oh, yes?" I responded politely. "Measures 80 values, temperature, UV index, dew point, you name it." He tilted the screen so I could see it. "That's heat stress." It was some meaningless number that ended in 2 decimal places. "It does solar radiation," he went on. "Barometric pressure, wind chill, rainfall, humidity, ambivalent and active, even estimated burn time adjusted for skin type." "Does it bake cookies?" I asked. He didn't like this. "There are times when I could save your life, believe me," he said, a little stoutly. I tried to imagine a situation in which I might find myself dangerously imperiled by a rising dew point, and could not. But I didn't want to upset the man, so I said, "What's that?" and pointed at a blinking figure in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. "Ah, I'm not sure what that is, but this," he stabbed the console of buttons, "now this is solar radiation."
It was another meaningless figure to three decimal places.
"It's very low today," he said, and angled the machine to take another reading. "Yeah, very low today."
Somehow I knew this already. In fact, although I couldn't attest any of it to three decimal places, I had a pretty good notion of the weather conditions generally, on account of I was out in them. The interesting thing about the man was that he had no pack, and so no waterproofs, and was wearing shorts and sneakers. If the weather did swiftly deteriorate, and in New England it most assuredly can, he would probably die. But at least he had a machine that would tell him when, and let him know his final dew point. I hate all this technology on the trail. Some AT hikers, I had read, now carry laptop computers and modems so that they can file daily reports to their family and friends. And now, increasingly, you find people with electronic gizmos like the Enviro monitor, or wearing sensors attached by wires to their pulse points so that they can look as if they come to the trail straight from some sleep clinic. In 1996, the Wall Street Journal ran a splendid article on the nuisance of satellite navigation devices, cell phones, and other such appliances in the wilderness. All this high-tech equipment, it appears, is drawing up into the mountains people who perhaps shouldn't be there. At Baxter State Park in Maine, the Journal reported, one hiker called up a National Guard unit and asked them to send a helicopter to airlift him off Mount Katahdin because he was tired. On Mount Washington, meanwhile, two very demanding women, according to an official there, called the Mountain Patrol HQ and said they couldn't manage the last mile and a half to the summit, even though there were still 4 hours of daylight left. They asked for a rescue team to come and carry them back to their car. The request was refused. A few minutes later, they called again and demanded, in that case, that a rescue team bring them some flashlights. That request was refused also. A few days later, another hiker called and requested a helicopter because he was a day behind schedule and was afraid he would miss an important business meeting. The article also described several people who had got lost with satellite navigation devices. They were able to report their positions as 36.2 degrees north by 17.48 degrees west, or whatever, but unfortunately didn't have the faintest idea what that meant, as they hadn't brought maps or compasses or, evidently, brains. My new friend on Stratton, I believe, could have joined their club. I asked him whether he felt it was safe for me to make a descent with solar radiation showing 18.574.
"Oh, yeah," he said quite earnestly.
"Solar radiation-wise, today is very low risk."
"Thank goodness," I said, quite earnestly too, and took my leave of him in the mountain. And so I proceeded across Vermont in a series of pleasant day hikes, without anything electronic, but with some very nice packed lunches that my wife made for me each night before retiring and left on the top shelf in the fridge. Despite my earlier vow not to hike with the car, I found it rather suited me here, indeed completely suited me. I could hike all day and be home for dinner. I could sleep in my own bed and each day set off in clean, dry clothes with a fresh packed lunch. It was nearly perfect. And so, for a happy 3 weeks, I commuted to the mountains. Each morning I would rise at dawn, put my lunch in my pack, and drive over the Connecticut River to Vermont. I would park the car and walk up a big mountain or across a series of rolling green hills. At some point in the day when it pleased me, usually about 11 a.m., I would sit on a rock or a log, take out my packed lunch, and examine the contents. I would go as appropriate, "Peanut butter cookies, my favorite!" Or, "Oh, hum, lunch and meat again," and eat in a zestful, chewy silence, thinking of all the mountaintops I had sat on with cats where we would have killed for this. Then I would pack up everything very neatly, drop it in my pack, and hike again till it was time to clock off and go home. And so passed late June and the first part of July. I did Stratton Mountain and Bromley Mountain, Prospect Rock and Spruce Peak, Baker Peak and Griffith Lake, White Rocks Mountain, Button Hill, Killington Peak, Gifford Woods State Park, Quimby Mountain, Thistle Hill, and finally concluded with a gentle 11-mile amble from West Hartford to Norwich. This took me past Happy Hill Cabin, the oldest shelter on the AT, and possibly the most sweetly picturesque. Soon afterwards it was torn down by some foolishly unsentimental trail officials. And the town of Norwich,
which is notable principally for being the town that inspired the Bob Newhart show on television, the one where he ran an inn and all the locals were charmingly imbecilic, and for being the home of the great Alden Partridge, of whom no one has ever heard. Partridge was born in Norwich in 1755 and was a demon walker, possibly the first person on the whole planet who walked long distances for the simple pleasure of it. In 1785, he became superintendent of West Point at the unprecedentedly youthful age of 30, then had some kind of falling out there and moved back to Norwich and set up a rival institution, the American Literary, Scientific, and Military Academy. There, he coined the term physical education and took his appalled young charges on brisk rambles of 35 or 40 miles over the neighboring mountains. In between times, he went off on more ambitious hikes of his own. On a typical trip, he strode 110 miles over the mountains from Norwich to Williamstown, Massachusetts, essentially the route I had just completed in gentle stages, trotted up Mount Greylock, and came back home the same way. The trip there and back took him just 4 days, and this is at a time, remember, when there were no maintained footpaths or helpful blazes. He did this sort of thing with virtually every peak in New England. There ought to be a plaque to him somewhere in Norwich to inspire the few hardy hikers still heading north at this point, but sadly there is none. From Norwich, it is about a mile to the Connecticut River, and a pleasant, unassuming 1930s bridge leading to the state of New Hampshire and the town of Hanover on the opposite bank. The road that led from Norwich to Hanover was once a leafy, gently sinuous two-lane affair, the sort of tranquil, alluring byway you would hope to find connecting two old New England towns a mile apart. Then some highway official or other decided that what would be a really good idea would be to build a big, fast road between the two towns. That way, people could drive the 1 mile from Norwich to Hanover perhaps as much as 8 seconds faster and not have to suffer paroxysms of anguish if somebody ahead wanted to turn onto a side road, because now there would be turning lanes everywhere, big enough for a truck pulling a Titan missile to maneuver through without rolling over a curb or disrupting the vital flow of traffic. So they built a broad, straight highway, 6 lanes wide in places, with concrete dividers down the middle and outsized sodium street lamps that light the night sky for miles around. Unfortunately, this had the effect of making the bridge into a bottleneck where the road narrowed back to 2 lanes. Sometimes 2 cars would arrive simultaneously at the bridge, and one of them would have to give way, well, imagine. So, as I write, they are replacing that uselessly attractive old bridge with something much grander and in keeping with the age of concrete. For good measure, they are widening the street that leads up a short hill to the center of Hanover and its handsome historic green. Of course, that means chopping down trees all along the street and drastically foreshortening most of the front yards with concrete retaining walls, and even a highway official would have to admit that the result is not exactly a picture, not something you want to put on a calendar called Beautiful New England. But it will shave a further 4 seconds off that daunting trek from Norwich, and that's the main thing. All of this is some significance to me, partly because I live in Hanover, but mostly, I believe, because I live in the late 20th century. Luckily, I have a good imagination, so as I strode from Norwich to Hanover, I imagine not a lively mini-expressway, but a country lane shaded with trees, bounded with hedges and wildflowers, and graced with a stately line of modestly scaled lampposts, from each of which was suspended, upside down, a highway official. And I felt much better. Chapter 17. Of all the catastrophic fates that can befall you in the out-of-doors, perhaps none is more eerily unpredictable than hypothermia. There is scarcely an instance of hypothermic death that isn't in some measure mysterious and improbable. Consider a small story related by David Quammen in his book Natural Acts. In the late summer of 1982, 4 youths and 2 men were on a canoeing holiday in Banff National Park when they failed to return to their base camp at the end of the day. The next morning, a search party went out looking for them. They found the missing canoeists floating dead in their life jackets in a lake. All were face up and composed. Nothing about them indicated distress or panic. One of the men was still wearing his hat and glasses. Their canoes, drifting nearby, were sound, and the weather overnight had been calm and mild. For some unknowable reason, the six had carefully left their canoes and lowered themselves fully dressed into the cold water of the lake, where they had peacefully perished. In the words of a member of the search party, it was like they had just gone to sleep. In a sense, they had. Popular impressions to the contrary, relatively few victims of hypothermia die in extreme conditions, stumbling through blizzards or fighting the bite of Arctic winds. To begin with, relatively few people go out in that kind of weather, and those that do are generally prepared. Most victims of hypothermia die in a much more dopey kind of way, in temperate seasons and with the air temperature nowhere near freezing. Typically, they are caught by an unforeseen change of conditions or combination of changes, a sudden drop in temperature, a cold pelting rain, the realization that they are lost, for which they are emotionally or physically under-equipped. Nearly always, they compound the problem by doing something foolhardy, leaving a well-marked path in search of a shortcut, blundering deeper into the woods when they would have been better off staying put, fording streams that get them only wetter and colder. Such was the unfortunate fate of Richard Salinas, who in 1990 went hiking with a friend in Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina. Caught by fading light, they headed back to their car, but somehow became separated. Salinas was an experienced hiker, and all he had to do was follow a well-defined trail down a mountain to a parking lot. He never made it. 3 days later, his jacket and knapsack were found abandoned miles into the woods. His body was discovered 2 months later, snagged on branches in the Little Linville River. As far as anyone can surmise, he had left the trail in search of a shortcut, got lost, plunged deep into the woods, panicked, and plunged deeper still, until at last hypothermia fatally robbed him of his senses. Hypothermia is a gradual and insidious sort of trauma. It overtakes you literally by degrees as your body temperature falls and your natural responses grow sluggish and disordered. In such a state, Salinas had abandoned his possessions and soon after made the desperate and irrational decision to try to cross the rain-swollen river, which in normal circumstances he would have realized could take him only farther away from his goal. On the night he got lost, the weather was dry and the temperature in the 40s. Had he kept his jacket and stayed out of the water, he would have had an uncomfortably chilly night and a story to tell. Instead, he died. A person suffering hypothermia experiences several progressive stages, beginning as you would expect with mild and then increasingly violent shivering as the body tries to warm itself with muscular contractions, proceeding on to profound weariness, heaviness of movement, a distorted sense of time and distance, and increasingly helpless confusion resulting in a tendency to make imprudent or illogical decisions, and a failure to observe the obvious. Gradually, the sufferer grows thoroughly disoriented and subject to increasingly dangerous hallucinations, including the decidedly cruel misconception that he is not freezing but burning up. Many victims tear off clothing, fling away their gloves, or crawl out of their sleeping bags. The annals of trail deaths are full of stories of hikers found half-naked, lying in snowbanks just outside their tents. When this stage is reached, shivering ceases as the body just gives up and apathy takes over. The heart rate falls and brain waves begin to look like a drive across the prairies. By this time, even if the victim is found, the shock of revival may be more than his body can bear. This was neatly illustrated by an incident reported in the January 1997 issue of Outside magazine. In 1980, according to the article, 16 Danish seamen issued a Mayday call, donned life jackets, and jumped into the North Sea as their vessel sank beneath them. There they bobbed for 90 minutes before a rescue ship was able to lift them from the water. Even in summer, the North Sea is so perishingly cold that it can kill a person immersed in it in as little as 30 minutes. So the survival of all 16 men was cause for some jubilation. They were wrapped in blankets and guided below, where they were given a hot drink and abruptly dropped dead, all 16 of them. But enough of arresting anecdotes. Let's toy with this fascinating malady ourselves. I was in New Hampshire now, which pleased me, because we had recently moved to the state, so I was naturally interested to explore it. Vermont and New Hampshire are so snugly proximate and so similar in size, climate, accent, and livelihood, principally skiing and tourism, that they are often bracketed as twins, But in fact they have quite different characters. Vermont is Volvos and antique shops and country inns with cutely contrived names, like Quail Hollow Lodge and Fiddlehead Farm Inn. New Hampshire is guys in hunting caps and pickup trucks, with license plates bearing the feisty slogan, "Live Free or Die." The landscape, too, differs crucially. Vermont's mountains are comparatively soft and rolling, and its profusion of dairy farms gives it a more welcoming and inhabited feel. New Hampshire is one big forest. Of the state's 9,304 square miles of territory, some 85%, an area somewhat larger than Wales, is woods, and nearly all the rest is either lakes or above treeline. So, apart from the very occasional town or ski resort, New Hampshire is primarily, sometimes rather dauntingly, wilderness. And its hills are loftier, craggier, more difficult and forbidding than Vermont's. In the Thru-Hiker's Handbook, the one indispensable guide to the AT, I might just say here, the great Dan Wingfoot Bruce notes that when the northbound hiker leaves Vermont, he has completed 80% of the miles, but just 50% of the effort. The New Hampshire portion alone, running 162 miles through the White Mountains, has 35 peaks higher than 3,000 feet. New Hampshire is hard. I had heard so much about the ardors and dangers of the White Mountains that I was mildly uneasy about venturing into them alone. Not terrified exactly, but prepared to be if I heard just one more bear chase story. So you may conceive my quiet joy when a friend and neighbor named Bill Abdu offered to accompany me on some day hikes. Bill is a very nice fellow, amiable and full of knowledge, experienced on mountain trails, and with the inestimable bonus that he is a gifted orthopedic surgeon. Just what you want in a dangerous wilderness. I didn't suppose he'd be able to do much useful surgery up there, but if I fell and broke my back, at least I'd know the Latin names for what was wrong with me. We decided to start with Mount Lafayette, and to that end set off by car one clear July dawn and drove the 2 hours to Franconia Notch State Park, a notch in New Hampshire parlance as a mountain pass, a famous beauty spot at repose beneath commanding summits in the heart of the 700,000-acre White Mountain National Forest. Lafayette is 5,249 feet of steep, heartless granite. An 1870s account, quoted in Into the Mountains, observes, "Mount Lafayette is a true Alp, with peaks and crags on which lightnings play, its sides brown with scars and deep with gorges." All true. It's a beast. Only nearby Mount Washington exceeds it for both heft and popularity as a hiking destination in the White Mountains. From the valley floor, we had 3,700 feet of climb, 2,000 feet of it in the first 2 miles, and three smaller peaks en route, Mount Liberty, Little Haystack, and Mount Lincoln. But it was a splendid morning, with mild but abundant sunshine, and that invigorating, minty clean air you get only in northern mountains. It had the makings of a flawless day. We walked for perhaps 3 hours, talking little because of the steepness of the climb, but enjoying being out and keeping a good pace. Every guidebook, every experienced hiker, every signboard beside every trailhead parking lot warns you that the weather in the White Mountains can change in an instant. Stories of campers who go for a stroll along sunny heights in shorts and sneakers, only to find themselves, 3 or 4 hours later, stumbling to unhappy deaths in freezing fog, are the stuff of every campfire. But they are also true. It happened to us when we were a few hundred feet shy of the summit of Little Haystack Mountain. The sunshine abruptly vanished, and from out of nowhere a swirling mist rolled into the trees. With it came a sudden fall in temperature, as if we had stepped into a cold store. Within minutes the forest was settled in a great foggy stillness, chill and damp. Timberline in the White Mountains occurs as low as 4,800 feet, about half the height in most other ranges, because the weather is so much more severe, and I began to see why. As we emerged from a zone of Krumholz, the stunted trees that marked the last gasp of forest at treeline, and stepped onto the barren roof of Little Haystack, we were met by a stiff, sudden wind, the kind that would snatch a hat from your head and fling it 100 yards before you could raise a hand, which the mountain had deflected over us on the sheltered western slopes, but which here was flying unopposed across the open summit. We stopped in the lee of some boulders to put on waterproofs for the extra warmth as much as anything, for I was already quite damp from the sweat of effort and the moist air. a clearly foolish state to be in with the temperature falling and the wind whisking away any body heat. I opened my pack, rooted through the contents, and then looked up with that confounded expression that comes with the discovery of a reversal. I didn't have my waterproofs. I rooted again, but there was hardly anything in the pack. A map, a light sweater, a water bottle, and a packed lunch. I thought for a moment, and with a small inward sigh, remembered pulling the waterproofs out some days before and spreading them out in the basement to air. I hadn't remembered to put them back. Bill, tightening a drawstring on his windcheater hood, looked over. "Something wrong?" I told him. He made a grave expression. "Do you want to turn back?" "Oh, no." I genuinely didn't want to. Besides, it wasn't that bad. There wasn't any rain, and I was only a little chilly. I put the sweater on and felt immediately better. Together we looked at his map. We had done almost all the height, and it was only a mile and a half along a ridgeline to Lafayette, at which point we would descend steeply 1,200 feet to Greenleaf Hut, a mountain lodge with a cafeteria. If I did need to warm up, we would reach the hut a lot faster than if we went 5 miles back down the mountain to the car. "You sure you don't want to turn back?" "No," I insisted. "We'll be there in half an hour." So we set off again into the galloping wind and depthless gray murk. We cleared Mount Lincoln at 5,100 feet, then descended slightly to a very narrow ridgeline. Visibility was no more than 15 feet, and the winds were razor sharp. Air temperature falls by about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit with every 1,000 feet of elevation, so it would have been chillier at this height anyway, but now it was positively uncomfortable. I watched with alarm as my sweater accumulated hundreds of tiny beads of moisture, which gradually began to penetrate the fabric and join the dampness of the shirt beneath. Before we had gone a quarter of a mile, the sweater was wet through and hanging heavily on my arms and shoulders. To make things worse, I was wearing blue jeans. Everyone will tell you that blue jeans are the most foolish item of clothing you can wear on a hike. I had contrarily become something of a devotee of them because they are tough and give good protection against thorns, ticks, insects, and poison ivy, perfect for the woods. However, I freely concede that they are completely useless in cold and wet. The cotton sweater was something I had packed as a formality, as you might pack anti-snake bite medicine or splints. It was July, for goodness sake. I hadn't expected to need any kind of outerwear beyond possibly my trusty waterproofs, which of course I didn't have either. In short, I was dangerously misattired, and all but asking to suffer and die. I certainly suffered. I was lucky to escape with that. The wind was whooshing along noisily and steadily, at a brisk 25 miles an hour, but gusting to at least double that, and from ever-shifting directions. At times, when the wind was head-on, we would take 2 steps forward and 1 back. When it came from an angle, it gave us a stiff shove towards the edge of the ridge. There was no telling in the fog how far the fall would be on either side, but it looked awfully steep, and we were, after all, a mile up in the clouds. If conditions had deteriorated just a little, if the fog had completely obscured our footing, or the gusts had gathered just enough bump to knock a grown man over, we would have been pinned down up there, with me pretty well soaked through. 40 minutes before, we had been whistling in sunshine. I understood now how people die in the White Mountains every summer. As it was, I was in a state of mild distress. I was shivering foolishly and feeling oddly lightheaded. The ridge seemed to run on forever, and there was no guessing in the milky void how long it would be till the form of Lafayette would rise to meet us. I glanced at my watch. It was 11:02, just right for lunch, when and if we ever got to the godforsaken lodge, and took some comfort from the thought that at least I still had my wits about me. Or at least I felt as if I did. Presumably, a confused person would be too addled to recognize that he was confused. Ergo, if you know that you are not confused, then you are not confused. Unless, it suddenly occurred to me, and here was an arresting notion, unless persuading yourself that you are not confused is merely a cruel early symptom of confusion, or even an advanced symptom. Who could tell? For all I knew, I could be stumbling into some kind of helpless pre-confusional state, characterized by the fear on the part of the sufferer that he may be stumbling into some kind of helpless pre-confusional state. That's the trouble with losing your mind. By the time it's gone, it's too late to get it back. I glanced at my watch again, and discovered with horror that it was still only 11:02. My sense of time was going. I might not be able to reliably assess my faltering brain, but here was proof on my wrist. How long would it be till I was dancing around half-naked and trying to beat out flames, or seized with the brilliant notion that the best way out of this mess would be to glide to the valley floor